Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 19th of February, these are our main stories. As hundreds of passengers disembark from the cruise liner moored off Yokohama in Japan, experts ask whether the quarantine attempt has worked. China pulls the credentials of three Wall Street Journal reporters over a coronavirus opinion piece they didn't even write. Post-Brexit Britain outlines the new hoops immigrants must jump through. And there's a controversy at the Brit Awards as a rapper calls the Prime Minister a racist on live TV. Also in this podcast,
women think that men like the thrill of the chase. And so they feel that women shouldn't initiate dates because that'll be a turnoff to men. That was not what I found.
New research claims to reveal the truth about modern dating. But we begin in Japan, where after spending 2 weeks in quarantine, hundreds of passengers who've tested negative for the COVID-19 coronavirus have begun leaving a cruise ship moored off the city of Yokohama. More than 500 passengers and crew on the Diamond Princess have been infected by the virus, the biggest cluster outside mainland China. Our correspondent, Laura Bicker, is at the dock in Yokohama, and I asked her how this process has been managed.
Well, first of all, they've had to test negative for coronavirus on a number of occasions. Then they seem to come out in various waves and get themselves onto buses. Some of the buses look as if they've taken serious precautions. There's kind of plastic sheeting between the driver and the passengers. But other passengers were just simply taking their luggage, grabbing a taxi or getting into a friend's car and leaving. That was it. That 14 days of quarantine all over. Finally, they get set foot on tarmac. But for others, we have seen a number of buses which seem to be flanked by ambulances, and I'm told that those are the buses that are off to quarantine facilities with those who've tested positive for the virus.
Now, what's life been like for these people who've been on this ship that everyone around the world has been following?
Anxious, boring is another phrase I've had. I think many of them have come off and you just said, yeah, I'm fine, and kind of huddled away from the press. But we have heard from one professor, Professor Iwate from Kobe University. Now, he managed to get on the ship. He's a specialist in contagious diseases. And he has even worked on Ebola. But he said that what he saw when he got on the Diamond Princess was frightening.
I was so scared that anybody could have a virus and everywhere could be contaminated by virus. So I got shocked and I was scared of having an infection inside the cruise ship. And I still am scared of developing a disease in the next couple of days.
And Laura, what happens to those who tested positive for COVID-19?
They're being treated and monitored in hospitals, in nearby hospitals to Yokohama. Again, they're not sure when they'll be able to get home. These are passengers that have already been on a ship, frustrated, angry, anxious for 14 days. And now we're told that those who have tested positive for the virus don't even have a hospital bed to go to. However, many are testing positive even though they are showing no symptoms. And that's one of the reasons why so many people are concerned. If you're travelling around with no symptoms, sometimes you're even testing negative for the coronavirus and then 2 days later testing positive. It's hard to know and hard to limit the spread of this disease.
Laura Bicker, a mixed approach reported there. So how effective has the two-week quarantine on board the ship actually been? Paul Hunter is a professor of health protection at the University of East Anglia.
I think it's fair to say that we haven't done a quarantine like this in my lifetime that I'm aware of. And, you know, I'm not young now, so that's a very long time. And, you know, and people have been desperately trying to do what they thought was in the best interests of public health globally. Now, if we look at the ship, it's not yet clear to me why the infection has spread so rapidly on the ship. I suspect the recent increase in numbers comes from the authorities testing people at the end of the quarantine and then finding that quite a few people were infected. So it's plausible that they could have been infected right at the beginning before any control measures were implemented, or that there has been continued transmission since then. So it may well be the case that we ultimately can't control this infection. But at the moment, there is no real evidence at the moment that, other than the Diamond Princess, that the virus is sustainably spreading person to person outside of China.
Paul Hunter of the University of East Anglia. The Chinese government, meanwhile, has revoked the press credentials of three reporters for the Wall Street Journal over an editorial about the new coronavirus. John Sudworth reports.
Headlined, "China is the real sick man of Asia," it argued that the outbreak of coronavirus highlights the deeper risks inherent in China's political system. In a statement, the Foreign Correspondents' Club of China called the decision an unprecedented form of retaliation. In recent years, at least six other reporters have been effectively expelled as the authorities allowed their visas to expire, but this is the first time in more than two decades that those still holding valid credentials have been ordered to pack up and go.
John Sudworth, the UN's human rights chief, has called for humanitarian corridors to relieve the pressure on the population of the northern Syrian province of Idlib. Michelle Bachelet has said that she's horrified by what's happening there and criticized what she called indiscriminate and inhumane attacks. But in a television address on Monday night, the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad reiterated his determination to retake the last areas of rebel-held territory in Syria. The UN says 900,000 Syrians have fled the fighting in Idlib since the beginning of December. Our correspondent Mike Thompson has been monitoring events there from London.
As Syrian government forces continue their advance into Idlib, the number of civilians fleeing before them in all manner of vehicles or on foot is soaring. Watching on in a village in the West Aleppo countryside is White Helmet's civil defence volunteer, Ismail Abdullah.
In the streets, people like Judgment Day, they all going north with their trucks, with their families, with their kids. Everyone is running, just fleeing nowhere, just to survive. We can watch and see and hear the sound of bombing. They're more than afraid, you know? They don't care anymore about the house that they will live in. They do not care about anything. Just they care about fleeing, be safe somewhere.
Most civilians flee north towards the closed Turkish border. For those who are sick and injured, medical help is hard to find, given the sheer weight of people needing it. Dr. Omar Al-Haraki works at the Bab al-Hawa Hospital near the border.
Our hospital receives an enormous number of patients who have been recently displaced. And to be specific, just for our hospital, who are responsible to receive 100,000 or 200,000 of people near the border, now we have to cover 1 million, and we are unable to provide our casualties with appropriate medical health.
Dr. Al-Haraki says there's no escaping either the bitter winter weather or the carnage.
There are no safe space in Idlib. Bombing and shelling and barrel bombs and are anywhere and everywhere. The Syrian regime attacked even the camps, and we receive babies, we receive girls and women in the camps. And when I want to discharge them home, they told me, "We don't have home, we don't have even a tent. Please let us in the hospital."
Activist and local aid worker Nur Kormush lives just west of Idlib city.
5 minutes ago, three missiles hit where I live. And right now, the warplanes are literally hovering in front of our heads. Right now in the streets, everyone saying that, "Can I survive here? Can I stay here? How am I going to protect my children from bombing?"
For some parents, the only solution is to tell their children that the explosions are from toys. And this father has turned guessing the sounds of bombs from shells into a game which his little daughter loves. Sadly, the bombing, shelling, homelessness and cold are all too real for hundreds of thousands of petrified people in Idlib, and their numbers are growing.
Mike Thompson, a landmark report, says not one single country in the world is protecting children's health, their environment, and their future. It was commissioned by the World Health Organization, the aid agency, UNICEF, and the medical journal The Lancet. The report argues that developed countries must do more to stop pervasive advertising aimed at selling children unhealthy food, as well as taking action to limit their CO2 emissions. Our global affairs correspondent, Naomi Grimley, has been reading it.
This report is clear. Even countries which have good healthcare systems and education provision are still being complacent about children's well-being. The report's authors, 40 paediatric health experts from around the world, say commercial marketing aimed at children urgently needs to become a major priority for policymakers. They argue it's linked to the alarming rise in childhood obesity, which is now 11 times what it was in 1975. The report also rounds on developed countries for excessive carbon emissions, which can have a devastating impact on children's health, from the proliferation of malaria and dengue fever to malnutrition.
Naomi Grimley, the Brit Awards held here in London are usually accompanied by some controversy, and this year's ceremony was no different. The rapper Dave criticised the treatment of Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, and accused the Prime Minister Boris Johnson of being a real racist during a politically charged performance. The British star, who won Best Album at the show, performed his song Black, but added new verses at the end while live on TV.
It is racist, whether or not it feels racist. The truth is our prime ministers are real racist. They say you should be grateful we're the least racist. I say the least racist is still racist.
Backstage, the BBC chatted to Dave about his performance.
Do you know what? I've been rehearsing for like 6 weeks. I don't know about nailed it, but I know that I didn't make any mistakes that were show-stopping. So it's a big, big weight off my shoulders now. I can just relax, get back to my normal life. Try and, you know, just live, because that performance has been on my mind for months now. Said what I needed to say. I'm just happy, really happy.
Well, this was the reaction of a senior minister in Boris Johnson's government, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
I did not see Rapper Dave's performance, but I simply do not subscribe to those comments at all. I know the Prime Minister. I've worked with the Prime Minister for a long time, for many years. He's absolutely not a racist. And I'm afraid that is very much a generalisation that has been made by Rapper Dave, and I just disagree with it.
Elsewhere at the show, the American singer Billie Eilish performed the new Bond theme tune and spoke out about cyberbullying, as Peter Goffin explains.
Now, she's just 18 years old. She won 5 awards at the Grammys last month, and she's just released the theme for the next James Bond film, No Time to Die, which she performed live for the first time at the Brits.
No time to die. No time to die.
Now, she had this to say when she was accepting her award.
I've felt very hated recently. And when I was on the stage and I saw you guys all smiling at me, it genuinely made me want to cry. And I want to cry right now. So thank you.
Now, this week, Billie Eilish spoke out about the cruelty and criticism that she's faced on social media, saying she's had to stop reading comments about herself because, in her words, they were ruining my life. Now, that kind of online harassment is obviously a huge problem for anyone in the public eye in 2020, but for women in particular. And actually, this year's Brit Awards were criticized for not having enough female nominees in the general categories like Song and Album of the Year.
Peter Goffin. Still to come in this podcast. Why this violinist is playing a favorite piece of music while surgeons operate on her brain.
The UK government has released its plan to introduce a points-based system aimed at curbing immigration into the country. Concern over the impact of high levels of immigration from the European Union was one of the key drivers behind the Brexit referendum in 2016. Future immigrants will have to be able to acquire 70 points under the new plan. So what does that mean and how do you get there? The BBC's Danny Shaw breaks it down.
To get to 70 points, which is the number that is required to be eligible to apply to come to the UK to work, you will need, first of all, an offer of a job by an approved sponsor, company, organisation. You would also need to have a job at an appropriate skill level, so it would have to be skilled work, and you would have to speak English. That would give you 50 points, and then you can get the additional 20 points that are needed, either because you've got a salary that's more than £23,000, or you have a job in an occupation where there's a labour shortage, for example, scientists, civil engineers, social workers, physics teachers, math teachers, or you have an education qualification of a PhD or equivalent.
And what happens when there are labour shortages in so-called low-skilled industries?
Well, this is the big question. There are some specific routes in for people who want to do fruit picking, for example. You know, that's a seasonal job and it requires a lot of people to do that for a fairly short period of time. So there'll be 10,000 places there. There'll also be some places for young people called the Youth Mobility Scheme to come here and work. And also foreign students, after they've graduated for 2 years, they can stay in the UK. They'll be able to stay in the UK and they can do any sort of work they want. But in terms of other lower-skilled work, there is no route in from outside the UK. And what the government is being quite robust and clear about this. It is saying to businesses that are worried that there would be a shortfall of workers, well, do more to retain your existing staff, become more productive, and embrace new technology and automation in order to keep your businesses going.
And briefly, how is this plan being received by industries that rely on immigration?
There's immense concern, particularly, I think, in the social care sector. There's no route in for lower skilled care assistants. Great concern there. And also in the hospitality industries, waiters, cooks, chambermaids, no route in for those people either.
Danny Shaw. Now to a sign of climate change that you might not have heard of before. Hundreds of thousands of mussels have been cooked to death on a beach in New Zealand's North Island, with experts saying more will die as the climate gets warmer. Someone living in the area posted a video online showing hundreds of dead shellfish on Maunganui Bluff Beach. Dr. Andrew Jeffs, a marine scientist from the University of Auckland, told Ben James what's happening to the shellfish.
This year, we have had a period of very fine, hot weather every day for several days. And so the mussels have just been literally baked in their shells each day under the hot sun. And after a few days, they've just given up. They've been cooked.
So why has this happened this year and it's not happened in the past?
It has happened 2 years ago in the same area. New Zealand during the summer typically has a very settled weather pattern, which goes on a sort of a 7 to 10 day cycle. And so we have fine weather for a couple of days, 2 or 3 days, and then it gets cloudy and then it'll rain and then it'll go back to being fine. We haven't had that weather pattern for the last few summers. We've had long, hot, dry spells with day after day of hot, sunny weather, which is great if you want to go to the beach, but not if you're at the beach as a mussel.
Tell us about the impact on the species then, for a start. If they're dying off in these sorts of numbers, is this going to put the mussel in danger in that part of New Zealand?
The species is actually quite widely found around New Zealand, and it's also an important commercial species. It's farmed in shallow coastal areas, and it produces around $300 million a year in production. So it's this northern area of the country where we're seeing the impacts on the mussel population. So I suspect most likely due to climate change, and we're seeing warmer conditions in the north, and it'll probably result in the mussel populations being displaced further south into cooler waters, or what is their normal temperature range that they can tolerate, the range that they don't get cooked in their shells in.
So this is a sort of canary in the coal mine, to mix animal metaphors, for climate change in your part of the world. What are the other species you're now looking at that could be affected next?
We're starting to see changes across a whole wide range of species, not just marine species, but also terrestrial species. And there's a lot of growing concern about particularly loss of biodiversity for particularly those species which have got limited ranges and are unable to move beyond their restricted range. So it's not just New Zealand, it's a global phenomenon. We're seeing fish populations or marine life populations moving poleward, i.e. to colder water further north and south, depending if you're in the northern or southern hemisphere, and into deeper water as well to try and get out of the increasing water temperatures in the shallow waters. And also, I mean, mussels are particularly important ecologically. They play a really important role in providing nursery habitats for other species, things like crabs and fishes. But they're also quite important in terms of filtering water and making food available at the surfaces of rocks, feeding rock pools and what have you in the marine environment.
Marine scientist Dr. Andrew Jeffs. Now, the thought of staying awake during surgery would terrify many of us, but what about during surgery to remove a brain tumor? Well, one woman in the UK did just that, and for a very good reason. Siobhan Leahy reports.
Dagmar Turner was introduced to Professor Kiumars Ashkan, a consultant neurosurgeon at King's College Hospital in London. An accomplished pianist with a degree in music himself, Professor Ashkan took a special interest in Dagmar, and together with his team of surgeons, an unusual plan was devised. They spent hours using MRI scanning to carefully map her brain and identify areas that were active when she played her violin. Once her skull was opened, they agreed with Dagmar they'd wake her from the anaesthetic so she could play. This would ensure the surgeons didn't damage the crucial areas of her brain that control her delicate hand movements. But Professor Ashkar said this unique procedure, which took between 6 and 7 hours, not only presented new medical challenges, but practical ones too.
Clearly, we had to make sure Dagmar wakes up in a position where she can immediately handle a violin. So that was also a bit tricky, and we had to plan ahead. And lastly, I had to make sure that as she moves the bow over the violin, it doesn't essentially come into my operative field or indeed hit me. So I had to make sure that the positioning was in a way that allowed her to freely use the bow without actually contaminating the operating field or actually causing collision with the surgical personnel.
And this is the moment, closely monitored by the anaesthetists, Dagmar woke to play the violin in the middle of her surgery. Yeah. 90% of the tumour was successfully removed, and to Professor Ashkar's amazement, Dagmar travelled home just 3 days after surgery. 3 weeks on, she says she's already playing her violin again and hopes to be back with the Isle of Wight Symphony Orchestra very soon.
Siobhan Leahy. Now to a topic we don't often cover here on the Global News podcast, modern dating. A new article based on research about the intersection between traditional dating rules and modern culture is sparking a lot of debate online. Ellen Lamont, an assistant professor of sociology at Appalachian State University in North Carolina, says her study found a huge difference between people's expectations of relationship equality and the reality of what they do. So should men still pay for dinners, initiate dates, and propose marriage in 2020? Alan Kasuja spoke to Ellen Lamont.
Basically, what I'm trying to say is that when people start dating, they come in with very explicit assumptions about what men and women want in those dating relationships. And so they think men want certain behaviors from women, and they think women want certain behaviors from men, based on stereotypes about men and women. They then enact those behaviors when they date.
Give me an example to illustrate your point.
So women think that men like the thrill of the chase. And so they feel that women shouldn't initiate dates because that'll be a turnoff to men, because it takes away their opportunity to give chase.
Right. And so what do you think is the basis of this thinking? Isn't this how we're mostly socialized?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that's what we're taught. Those are the stereotypes we're told about what men and women want from relationships. Yep.
Have they basis in fact?
No, that was not what I found.
What did you find?
I found that the men actually didn't want to necessarily do all of the asking, because there's a lot of pressure around asking for a date. You get rejected a lot. And so plenty of men found women initiating, or at least expressing outright interest in a date, was seen as attractive.
So what would be the rules? Are there any such things as farm rules, or are we basically saying that what applies to one person doesn't necessarily apply to the next person?
Well, I would say that people think there are rules. And so in a dating situation where you're kind of uncertain about the other person, you just make an assumption that that person is a stereotypical type of person because you don't know them very well.
Right.
And so you follow the rules. So the rules are that men should pay, that men should ask for the dates, that men should do the follow-up phone call, that men should initiate sex, that men should ask for a long-term commitment. And then
that they shouldn't? Because, you know, you're saying some really powerful stuff here. You're saying that men shouldn't be the ones to propose, basically.
They could be the ones to propose, but that also women, if they are interested in getting engaged, could also be the ones to propose.
And does it matter that someone says they're feminist but also want a man to pay for a meal or to propose marriage to them?
In some cases, yes. So I won't say absolutely. Some people did end up with equal marriages no matter what. But for many people, what happened is they brought the same assumptions about gender difference into their marriage. Hmm. So they thought it was going to become more equal, but then they were still operating from those same stereotypical assumptions. So it was basically hard to change the course of the relationship once you kind of become embedded in particular gender roles.
We have 10 seconds left. What about same gender relationships?
They were much more equal because they didn't want to follow those rules. They actually were explicit about not doing so.
Ellen Lamont of Appalachian State University in North Carolina. Now, if you have an eagle eye for product placement in movies, you may have seen it, a tin of crisps or potato chips in one scene of the hit movie Parasite. It wasn't necessarily a well-known brand beforehand, but as Riley Carlson tells us, it's getting much bigger thanks to the film.
That's the sound of potatoes dropping onto the production line at Bonilla a la Vista factory in northwestern Spain. The family-run potato chip company is about to need a lot more potatoes and is hiring more staff. A tin of the chips makes a cameo appearance in the hit movie Parasite. The 87-year-old owner, Cesar Bonilla, says the chips have been popular in Korea for years.
Los de Corea, le voy a contar.
The businessmen from South Korea came to Spain 3 or 4 times, and they visited many factories. But in the end, they decided they liked these ones.
Every year, his factory exports 60 tons of chips, and 2/3 end up in South Korea, where they've been popular with high-end consumers. Mr. Bonilla says online sales have surged 150% since the film's release.
I have tears in my eyes when I think about it. It was a mystery how this movie showed this can of Bonilla a la Vista, and then the movie got so distinguished.
Parasite has been gathering critical acclaim, becoming the first non-English language film to win an Oscar for Best Picture.
Riley Carlson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.